Today on Hear Us Out, Dr. Jay Verde is a historian of medicine, technology, and disability whose groundbreaking research redefines how we think about deafness, embodiment, and assistive technologies. She's the author of Hearing Happiness, Deafness Cures in History, a powerful, deeply personal book that blends memoir with cultural critique, uncovering the hidden histories of how society has sought to fix the deaf body. As an award-winning professor and public intellectual, Dr. Verde is reshaping the conversation around accessibility, inclusion, and historical narrative. So welcome to Hear Us Out.
Thank you so much, Eric and Michelle. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
We're excited to have you. Can you actually tell our listeners your story of becoming deaf, the origin of how you entered the community?
The origin of Jay, in other words.
Exactly.
I was born hearing. I was actually born in Kuwait to a Sikh family. I believe I first got ill with meningitis around age 4. And, meningitis, as many of us know, is one of the leading causes of hearing loss. And in my case, being in Kuwait, the predominantly Arabic physician didn't take my mother's pleas about my illness very seriously. And they were just dismissing it, just another case of the flu. But long story short, I was hospitalized for 6 months, lost my hearing, lost a little bit of my eyesight and my mobility. So everything I had to gain back again. And my parents tried all kinds of cures, religious cures, pharmaceutical cures, herbal remedies, folk remedies passed on by families and friends to try to, quote, fix me and bring me back to normal. Because as a hearing family, they thought my condition was just an illness that needs to be corrected. But it wasn't until, I would say, about age 6, when I got my first pair of behind-the-ear hearing aids that really helped me to regain a sense of my auditory environment. And then I went to a school for the deaf and hard of hearing and learned speech therapy from there. So in a sense, that's my youth. And then we can fast forward all the way to being an adult when I wore digital hearing aids and had to reacclimate to the auditory environment.
Going, if you can remember that far back, because you said it was about a 2-year period until you got your hearing aids. Mm-hmm. How was that for you? Being in a world of silence because you were born hearing, we see our adults that suddenly lose their hearing and it's a shock to them, let alone being a child.
Yeah. The thing that I remember the most was frustration. So I was a child prodigy who's, according to my family, spoke 7 languages, had perfect pitch with music. I would watch a Bollywood film and immediately pick up the song and dance routine that they used to show. I didn't understand what had happened. So I was 4 and trying to speak to my family members and explain, I don't understand what you are saying or why aren't you responding to me? And I didn't quite get the fact that they weren't hearing those words. They were just hearing gobbles because I wasn't speaking properly anymore. And I didn't understand why everybody around me were emotionally upset, like they encountered a trauma. So this was devastating for them, as much as that it was for me. So that's what I remember the most. But I have this very, very vivid memory of going with my father and my cousins to a Bhangra performance, which is a Sikh dance that relies heavily on drumming and a dance movement that jumps up and down. And I have this vivid memory of hearing those drum beats because, you know, it's vibration and it's very loud and I can feel the sensations of the music and, you know, seeing the colorful dancers in the bold colors moving and getting a sense of rhythm. I think that was one of the first times I realized that I was hearing something akin to music, but it was not music the way I had previously understood it. So I feel like that was around the time when I started very slowly understanding that something had changed, but it would take a very long time before I, as a child, I would understand what had happened. So it was frustration, and there was this sense of feeling isolated because I couldn't communicate with my family. And I was very close with my family. My cousin lived down the street, you know, one of my cousins my age lived next door. So we were very close. And that loneliness and increasing isolation kind of shaped my upbringing a little bit as well, because I started yearning for this connection.
Can you talk to us a bit about how you chose the history of medicine and disability as your area of research?
Of course, it wasn't intentional. I was one of those, you know, college students who didn't really have a career figured out. I like fashion, I like marketing, and I was doing something along the lines of fashion merchandising for retail shops. So I was designing like the windows and the displays and things like that. But I was constantly drawn to reading books in the history of medicine, you know, books about the stories about doctors and nurses and disabled people who encountered health issues, protested against healthcare disparities. I love reading about people's interaction with the influenza pandemic of 1919, for instance. And having that area of interest under my belt, I just applied for grad school and was very pleasantly surprised when I got it. I became the first member of my family to get a PhD. You know, it wasn't something that we strove to get. And I was quite excited about that. But picking a research subject was challenging because I knew I had interest in anatomy. I had interest in the history of medicine. I wasn't really thinking about disability, especially deafness, as a research topic, until I stumbled upon an anatomy textbook that was discussing deafness. And it had all these quotes from people who had encountered 19th century doctors. And the question that popped up to me at that moment was, how were people choosing what kind of care to receive? So why were they deciding to go to a surgeon for innovative surgery? Or how were they responding to an advertisement that was promoting a miraculous cure? Or how were they deciding whether or not they just wanted to be deaf? So these questions started to shape my early doctoral research. I really wanted to understand what the relationship between medical professionals and deaf people, how were they working together? How were they resisting each other? And how, in the middle of it all, how did capitalism, medical innovation, crack product in gimmicks, how did that come to be part of this history of deafness? So this research ended up becoming my first book that, as you mentioned, is titled Hearing Happiness.
Can you talk about some of the gimmicks that had been encountered over the years when it came to hearing loss and deafness?
Oh, there's so much. Honestly, my favorite is airplane diving, because I saw it as one of the most ridiculous and far-fetched theoretical idea about curing deafness. So it happened after the First World War. You have all these pilots who started working across North America as, like crop dusters. Mm-hmm. And some of them just would take planes on to give people the entertaining rides to go for the loops and all the daredevil stunts. One deaf person heard from a ex-soldier that if he went up about 13 feet and then dropped down suddenly, then his hearing would be returned. So this person tried it out, and the newspaper reported on it as the great new miracle cure for deafness, airplane diving. And this was in the early 1920s. And people really went for it. I mean, I was surprised, by the way, how popular it was. I'm going through newspaper archives, and they're everywhere. Almost every state in the United States, somebody had gone up on a
You're
plane.
You're kidding.
Yes. And there's dives and quick descent. And when they return to the ground, you know, to imagine like this crowd of people are rushing to the pilot and the person who's deaf coming out of the plane and asking, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And there's lots of reports about how successful airplane diving was. But here's the thing, it was also very dangerous. As many successful cases as there were also as many cases of the plane crashing and people dying.
Not surprising.
It became the worrying concern for governmental officials to get people to stop doing this. Like, they had famed otologists sending out letters to newspapers saying, please don't do this. This is not safe. But you also had otologists saying, oh, this actually works. Like, I have this many clients who've gone up on airplane diving and it works. Eventually, the fad faded away by the 1930s because too many people were dying, including children, from the plane crashes. And it was quite dangerous as well. There was no proven scientific document that said that airplane diving actually could cure deafness.
I'm trying to think of what the thought process even could be. And the best I can come up with is somebody has really thick fluid. Mm-hmm. You have a really quick either ascent or descent, and the eardrum ruptures, and all of a sudden you can hear better because the fluid drained. Yeah. Beyond that, I cannot come up with.
I can. Scientific.
Yeah, maybe people even had like blockages.
And like your station tube dysfunction, that it was.
Okay. That was a description a lot of people said. They felt a pop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it's the only thing that would make scientific sense to me is something you station tube related.
Was there anything in your research that did not surprise you that said, oh, this makes sense?
I would say what didn't surprise me was the number of people who reported that any of this advertised fad treatment, electrical treatment, were not effective. So I mean, I would be surprised if they were effective, because of course they're not effective. But that wasn't a big surprise. So a lot of complaints by people, especially to the American Medical Association, saying, you know, I answer this advertiser, this advertiser's promotion, and I gave them my hard-earned money only to be duped by their promises. So that wasn't really surprising. At the same time, it did surprise me how many people tried these all kinds of treatments, even without verification that it works. Something like 25,000-30,000 people would try an experimental, quote, finger surgery, in which a practitioner junior claimed that he could insert his fingers into people's ears and digitally manipulate a cure. And in his office, there's photographs of all kinds of people lining up for the miraculous treatment. Yeah, there's a lot of those.
People really grasp at straws.
How do those historic gimmicky treatment/cures compare to gimmicky treatments and cures that people will encounter today?
I think there's still this sense of hope that people have that these gimmicky treatments could offer an alternative to perhaps more costly medical technical treatment, because there is this belief that if this cure is presented, then it's presented with the sense of a promise, correct? And it fuels into people's hopes that they can be restored back to whatever their normal bandwidth is. So there's still a lot of that. I see ear waxing, for example, mm-hmm. ear candling. Yeah. I think that's the preferred term, where people put candle wax in the ear to pull out dried wax. So that's been around since the 16th century. It's a very long-term process of removing hardened wax from the ear. But when you remove the buildup of hardened wax, you get your hearing back. So people have often promoted it as, again, a miracle cure for deafness, not just we're cleaning out your ear and restoring what you already have.
What has the overall reception been to the book? Have you received positive feedback and even some sort of controversial feedback towards it?
For a book that came out in 2020, so at the height of COVID-19 pandemic, I am constantly blown away by how well the book has been received. You know, it's very hard to sell a book without bookstores. So everything's been done online. It's been really well received by all kinds of public. I mean, I've had educators, so professors who've assigned it for the classes, both undergraduate and graduate courses, and told me that the students really love the high readability of the prose, like a very accessible language. And that was by design. You know, academics have this habit of writing in really dense prose so that it's difficult to grasp the meaning of it. But for my first book, I wanted, as I said to my editor, I wanted to write a book that even my mom, who doesn't read, will read. So that was my goal. It's really surprised me how audiologists have also resonated really well with the book, seeing it as the foundational history as to how the field emerged. I've been really surprised when children come up to me and say, I read your book. I'm like, but you're 10 years old. So that's been really wonderful to say, to see, to be honest. But yeah, the Hearing Happiness has received really favorable review, press, some awards, which also put a lot of pressure on me for my next book. And
yeah. Of course. You set a high bar. And it's interesting that it came out at the height of COVID. We've saw patients that lost their hearing so suddenly due to COVID, or at least some sort of correlation. So it was more of this pandemic that completely changed their hearing, and they had to navigate their new normal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And speaking of new normal, why don't you talk a little bit about some of your advocacy work and what you're doing with Resound and their New Norm campaign?
Mm-hmm. One of the prime arguments I make in Hearing Happiness is that hearing is a spectrum. So there's an auditory spectrum, and there's, you know, full hearing, perfect pitch to complete deafness. But deafness is also a spectrum. And the ways in which we navigate the kind of treatment, speech, sign language, you know, captioning, et cetera, is very varied, and it's completely a personal choice. And I wanted to also put forth this idea that people who choose to wear hearing aids, especially, are trying to align with an aspect of their identity that doesn't always fit the normal expectation of what a deaf or hard of hearing person should be. And in so doing, they're really trying to dismantle stigma. And there's this really assertive part of this history as well. And that's also very much in present practice, where people are modifying their hearing aids, you know, putting stickers, jewelry, having bright colors for their devices or their ear molds. So Michelle, I can see that you also have colored ear molds as well.
Oh, yeah.
You see wearing that too? Both of you do, okay. So I see a lot of that. And it struck to me that there is this huge joy in this part of the history that can be a very powerful force to dismantle stigma. So when I was first approached by Julianne about the New Norm campaign, it felt like a natural fit with the work I was already doing as a researcher, the principles that I have for myself as a deaf person, and also the kind of advocacy work I was pushing for the future, like to acknowledge hearing and deafness and also the wearing of hearing aids, not as a negative disability, not as something to be stigmatized, but just another variation of what it means to be human.
In this day and age where social media and podcasting and YouTube are this big part of connecting and sharing information, do you feel like that plays a role in how people talk about disability? Like, we're doing a podcast right now where we're talking about it, and see, lots of actors are sharing their stories in a way where I feel like people didn't used to have the access to see that people with names do talk about it. And it was something that was so shied away from that I think people promote it more now. What are your thoughts on that?
I think social media has really changed your landscape of how we obtain information and how we learn new things. So one thing I really liked about social media, so TikTok, Instagram especially, is the rise of deaf creators who use sign language, speech, and wear hearing aids. So they're really showing to the public that there's no one way of being deaf. For example, I'm deaf. Like, I consider myself deaf. Audiologically, I am deaf. Like, I have 98% hearing loss. I also have speech, and I communicate primarily through oral communication because that's how I was trained as a child. But I also prefer to take off my hearing aids and just live in the blissful silence, especially after a very long, noisy day. And I know a little bit of sign language, but I'm not surrounded by signers. So the language, just like any other language, fades away when it's not practiced. And then there are people who wear cochlear implants and they communicate by speech, or cochlear implants and they use sign language. Some are artists, some are actors, like some are writers. There's this huge spectrum that we see on social media of what it means to be deaf and how these people are living deaf lives. And I think it's marvelous because one of the things I've seen as an historian over the 20th century is that while the first half of the 20th century, a lot of hearing aid manufacturers were advertising their products to a wide range of users, you know, mom, dad, children, grandparents, and all the different social environments in which good hearing was required, the second half of the 20th century predominantly focused on hearing aid as an age-related disability, so targeting elderly people predominantly. Mm-hmm. And it left off this wide range of users. So the new norm really brings those wide range of users back. So there was a historian, there is a musician, you know, a Paralympic athlete. So I thought that was really great that this messaging is being reinforced again. Now, deafness is a spectrum. And look at all these great ways that people are living their lives as deaf people, with or without a capital D, and as hearing aid wearers.
How do you define deafness for yourself? Or do you think that it just varies based on the individual? Does everybody define their own deafness?
I think it varies based on the individual. Disability can be a very personal thing. I say I'm deaf because I feel that much more accurate to who I am. And I remember growing up and my teachers, for instance, were labeling me as hard of hearing. And it never quite fit right with me, partly because I found myself being deafer than my deaf classmates. Like I wasn't hearing at the same wavelength they were. But it's a very, very personal definition, I would say.
We've heard from other guests that we have, that we've spoken with, who, whether they use cochlear implants, whether they use hearing aids, that they haven't quite felt a part of deaf culture and they haven't quite felt a part of the hearing world. And that was always kind of a conflict for them. Mm-hmm. Has that been something that you've wrestled with?
I think this idea of a binary does present some struggles for a lot of people. In my case, I went to a deaf and hard of hearing school. And in elementary school, everybody was being, in a sense, forced to be orally deaf. But then when we went to high school, the high school that we were in had a sign language program, and it required all the students who were in the deaf and hard of hearing department to go to the sign language program. So I was not in the deaf and hard of hearing department. I was placed in the gifted program. And I noticed that a lot of my friends who formerly used to speak felt more comfortable not speaking and rather communicating within sign language. And then there started to be a little bit of a split there because I wasn't very fluent in sign language. So when I struggled to communicate with them, and then by the time I switched high schools and went to a hearing school, I was no longer surrounded by deaf people for the most part. So the deaf culture faded away from me. But over the past few years, as I became more of an advocate for deafness and deaf people, I found myself connecting back to deaf culture in a way, joining the language and joining the arts as well, and bringing deaf culture back to the history that I write. So I don't personally feel now that there was a split between the hearing world and the deaf world. I feel like I'm moving in and out between both of them.
Something you had mentioned earlier is that at the end of a long day, you want to take out your hearing aids and sit in the silence, which is also something we've heard a lot from other guests. What is it about the silence that is appealing for you?
Oh, it's so peaceful. Imagine you can take a Zoom, you can just flip a switch and you shut off all external stimulation. And you just kind of just shut off your mind. That's what it feels like. And the thing is, I never used to do that. I had a lot of internalized ableism. and self-stigma about being a deaf person, especially as a teenager trying so hard to fit in. And I would wear my hearing aids all day. Like, even when they got heavy on my ears and hurt, I would still wear them. I wore them to bed sometimes because I thought that's what it meant to be, you know, cured. Like, you have to be able to hear all the time. That's what it meant to be normal. But now I want to have a good night's sleep, and I don't want to hear my dog or my husband moving around the house. I take them off and I have this peaceful sleep. It's helped a lot for me, especially in maintaining my mental health. So I find now the older I get, all these urban environment noises overstimulate me. So the trucks, cars honking, subway noises, all of that, I find that it triggers migraines. So when I'm out in this world, I just turn off my hearing aids and I get to be quiet and peaceful.
Don't we all wish we could turn off our ears sometimes?
What is the biggest challenge that your hearing situation poses for you?
I find there are technological limitations in hearing aid design now. So for about 30 years, I wore analog hearing aids, and they had a long shelf life. So 12, 15 years, something like that. And, you know, growing up wearing analog hearing aids raised this curiosity in me where I would tinker with them. Like, I would open them and do the little repairs myself and put them back together. I can't do that with digital hearing aids. And I feel like I've lost autonomy over the devices that I wear on a daily basis. I'm constantly fiddling with this sound that I know requires a computer to be fixed. I find that really frustrating. And it's a constant challenge in thinking about how technological innovation shapes accessibility as well. So I can't go back, for the most part, to the analog hearing aid that I wanted because we moved past that. It's now vintage.
That's tricky.
It was very difficult when digital power BTEs first came out to transition patients from analog to digital. We got so much pushback as audiologists from that. And then the hearing aid companies started to realize this, and they would allow us to try and mimic those analog settings within the digital hearing aids. But even that was very challenging for a lot of our patients to adapt to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the longest time, I've lost the ability to use the telephone. So the analog hearing aid had that telecoil switch, which I could just turn on and chat away on the phone. The Bluetooth feature can't pick up the frequency that I need to connect with my phone. So I'm no longer having the phone that you put on your ear. I'm now having the phone that you have in front of your face. Yeah. And trying to lip read. So that required a lot of retraining of myself in trying to calibrate my hearing aid with the phone technology. It is frustrating. But I mean, I'm not surprised there's pushback. You're basically saying, for all this time, I wore my hearing aid in this one way, and I've adapted my body and my mind to nicely pair with this device. And now you're saying I have to change and start all over again. So there was a lot of frustration with that. Yeah.
You know, it's a common conversation that I'll have with our students that patients who have severe to profound hearing loss oftentimes know better than you do what they need. Mm-hmm. That there are times with some of our patients where we'll say, hey, I think this is what you should try. Why don't you see if you can get used to it? Mm-hmm. But with our patients who have severe to profound loss, I find you're telling us what you want and we're trying to deliver that to you.
Yeah, and it's like, what's wrong with how I've been living? Why are you telling me to change?
Most times they tell me to crank it up.
Yeah.
And we do. There's so many misconceptions out there about hearing loss, deafness, disability in general. Is there anything that stands out to you that you would like to clarify for people?
Yes, that would be, in addition to this concept that deafness, hearing is a spectrum of experiences, there's also no one way of being deaf. And that also includes the fact that not every person wants a cure. Not every person wants to wear a hearing aid. And I think we need to accept that as well.
Have you ever had, without knowing your specific hearing loss, have you ever had an internal debate of whether amplification versus implantable technology was a route that you wanted to consider if implantable is an option for you?
So, totally not when I was young. I mean, I didn't have any decision in the matter. It was my parents making decisions in accordance with my audiologist. As an adult, I was very surprised when an audiologist told me I was the perfect candidate for a cochlear implant, which is not something I've ever thought about or something that I think I want. I mean, it's brain surgery in a sense, and I feel perfectly fine wearing my hearing aid. So that has been the only debate, shall we say, that I've encountered. But as I get older, sometimes I wonder if implantable options would be better for me, provide a, I would say, an easier route to sound. Because I do find myself struggling sometimes to understand speech as clearly as I used to when I was younger. So at this age, and I'm fine saying my age, I'm 43, I don't know how much of it is age related, how much of it is my hearing aids, and how much of it is that I'm just in a noisy environment. And even how much of it is it's just me losing patience with people when they're talking. And I just want them to hurry up and finish.
One idea that I would push back on slightly is the idea of cochlear implant surgery as brain surgery. It's near the brain, but they don't actually have to go to the brain. And it doesn't mean it's without risks. But it's an interesting idea. And we have this conversation with a lot of our patients when we introduce the idea of cochlear implantation. And it can take many years from that first introducing the idea to a patient deciding to go ahead with it. And one of the surgeons we work with, who I have a lot of respect for, said to a mutual patient, "You'll know when you're ready for it. It's not for us to tell you when you're ready for it. We can tell you you're a candidate, but you'll know when you're ready." And is it something in your head that you even debate, or are you just comfortable with the setup that you use now?
That's a really nice way to phrase it. You know when you're ready for it. I don't think about it, to be honest, because I don't constantly think about my hearing aids. They're just there. They're just something I wear. I only seem to veer toward it when I get frustrated with my own device's limitation. So I've only, the one that I have now, I have a pair of ReSound. I've only had them for about 2 years now, so I'm still learning how to.
Which ones do you have?
ReSound Endo, I think.
Enzo Q, probably.
So my last question for you is, are there any either close or different topics of research that you're interested in delving to in the near future? What is next in your topic of interest that you'd like to explore?
Actually, my next project looks at hearing aid design. So I wrote about hearing aid marketing, but now I'm really interested in hearing aid design. I'm examining how hard of hearing people participated with manufacturers to improve the design of hearing aids, both in the technical features, but also in the more aesthetic design, and how that has shaped the design of BTE and in the hearing aid that we know today. And what does it mean when we bring fashion back? So what happened if we have all various kinds of hearing aids the way we have with spectacles, for instance? So can we have a new brand of hear wear, like we think about eyewear, that is purely about fashion and personal preference? So this is what I'm looking at for my next book.
That is fascinating. I can't tell you how many patients I would expect would be more likely to wear it if it was aesthetically or fashion driven.
Now, for my last question, I'd be curious, what's maybe one idea or assumption that people hold about deafness or disability in general that you would want to challenge our listeners in terms of the way they think about the world?
I think we can start to, I mean, go back to what I said earlier, that there's no one way of being deaf. And we can also go back to earlier conversation about the New Norm campaign and how we're dismantling stigma. So we really need to accept, I would say, that deafness is a part of the human condition. And more broadly than that, there's this line, sorry, my brain is like going many different directions, but there's this line in the disability community that says we are all temporarily abled. So everybody is going to become disabled in one point or another their life. And the more we accept that, the more we can accept human diversity of all kinds. And that's a good way to think about how we can approach breaking down stigma.
I really like that. We all have our things.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Verdi, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing about you and your book and your research. It certainly has opened our eyes, and I'm sure for our listeners as well. And we look forward to seeing what you're going to do next in terms of your next project. Yep. Good point.
Why don't you let everybody know where they can find your book and where they can connect with your work now and down the road?
Hearing Happiness is available wherever bookstores are sold. You can get it in an online retailer. And to keep updated with my latest work, come onto my website, which is jverdi.com.
And we'll link to that in the episode description as well. Dr. Verdi, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for coming on to Hear Us Out today.